I don't think I'd like to produce anybody at the moment. I've been in studios for the last 18 months, working on the two films. I don't think I could actually stand to sort of be inside a studio for too long at the moment. I was, musical director of both films, which meant I was in charge of mixing the sound and the dubbing and everything. Most of the material was in pretty good shape. There was a lot of, in the Kids Are Alright film, there was a lot of old footage that really needed reworking. It was really sort of instruments missing and sort of drums fading out halfway through and stuff like that, and we had to do a lot of work on it, but most of the new footage that we did was pretty good. But it was given to us in so many different forms. Some of it was mono optical, some was on video. Most of the stuff didn't really have the master tapes, so we had to work from optical sound, which was pretty lousy. A lot of the stuff had the bass guitar missing because no one knew how to record it on stage. So I did a bit of bass overdubbing for the film. The Kids Are Alright is really a documentary, I suppose. It's not in any chronological order. That would be a little bit too boring. I mean, the sound would go from lousy to good, only it would take about 2 hours to get there. So we've jumbled it up with different interviews in between the songs, and we bounce around from 1965 through to 1977, and just bounce around. The oldest footage we've got is us playing at a place called the Railway Hotel, which is where our manager, Kit Lambert, first discovered us, and he actually did the film work on it. As far as old American tours are concerned, I think the earliest American thing we've got is a shindig that we did, but we did that in London. The only TV appearance we've ever actually done in the States was from the Smothers Brothers show, and that more or less opens the film up. My first bass guitar only lasted about 2 months, mainly because I made it myself, and I left it draped across an armchair one day, and I bent down to pick a plectrum up, and I slipped and put my hand on the neck join, and it just concertinaed and turned into a four-string harp. It's had it. The oldest bass I've got is the oldest bass in my sort of possession that I've actually sort of used all the time is an old 65 Precision that I used through all the Tommy tours. And the first 10 tours of the States, I was using an old Precision. I usually change my instruments if I think I'm getting in some kind of rut, as far as bass playing is concerned. If I find I'm playing the same old licks over and over again and using the same sound all the time, the easiest way for me to change my style is to change all the equipment. So I suppose I made two major changes. I started off with a Precision and got a certain kind of sound, very trebly, sort of twangy sound. And then after the Live at Leeds album, I started getting stuck in a rut. We were playing Tommy and Live at Leeds on stage, and I found I was just playing the stuff from the albums. I wasn't making up anything new, so I thought, well, I've got to get out of this. So I changed to using a Gibson Thunderbird with Sun amps, and about 6 years ago I changed back to the twangy sound again and started using Alembic basses with Sun amps. I came over initially to cut the lacquers for the Kids Are Alright soundtrack album, and I thought, well, I'm sort of paying out for air tickets, so I might as well sort of stay over for an extra few weeks and do some songwriting, because I don't seem to be writing that many songs at home. There's too many things to think about when you're at home, so I'm stuck out here in Los Angeles, no responsibilities, no worries, so I thought I might be able to write better. So I brought a mobile studio over, shipped it over from England. I spend most of my time recovering various hangovers. You know. I sit slumped in the armchairs and sort of watch television all day and then go out at night. I've got a couple of ideas for songs, but it's getting pretty slow. I've got two more weeks to go yet. I think LA is creative because it's a completely different environment. I suppose it's sort of Music City in a way for me. As I said, that I've got so few responsibilities. All I've got to do is get up in the morning and go to sleep. So I haven't got any board meetings to worry about or anything like that. And the sun shines most of the time. So I figured I'd write much sunnier songs over here than England. And in England, I was writing songs about tax and, really sort of political songs I was getting into, and I just didn't want to write that sort of stuff. I've had such a low profile because I basically, in the early days, I was very lazy. I didn't really sort of want to do interviews. I didn't really want to be a pop star. You know, I thought of myself more as a musician. You know, and I wanted to be respected as a musician. I never really built my career around being a sort of rock idol or anything. So the media and the press sort of accepted the fact that I was the one that didn't say anything. You know, and I got labelled as the quiet one. And once you've got that label, you stay the quiet one for the rest of your life. Yeah. My duties with The Who at the moment are sort of as musical director, I suppose. You know, I do all the actual mixing of the records and stuff. At the moment, I'm writing, you know, up to like sort of 30% of The Who material goes on record. I suppose my job within The Who is the sort of music side of things. You know, the actual sort of getting the sort of finished record on disc. And the first Who album, I hadn't actually started writing. With the second one, Happy Jack, we got offered this publishing deal that if everybody in the band wrote two songs, we'd each get something like $1,000. You know, and we were pretty short of cash, so we all wrote two songs for it. You know? And I mean, that really got me into writing. The next album, I only managed to write one. I wrote a lot of B-sides in the meantime. And then we got to Tommy. I wrote Cousin Kevin and Fiddle About. You know, I invented the two horrible characters in Tommy. And then with Quadrophenia, Pete had written all the material, you know, sort of ahead of time. And he'd got the whole sort of concept sewn up, so there weren't any of my compositions on that. I think my favourite compositions, sort of Who-wise, have been Heaven and Hell and My Wife. They were the two that were played a lot on stage. About the most popular one with the fans, I think, has been Boris the Spider. You know, the old Who fans always, you know, sort of like to hear that on stage, although we haven't played it for quite a few years now. I think that the biggest song has been My Wife up to now. Back with the earlier albums, I was more or less at every recording session, but I mean, we all more or less sort of directed our own parts. You know, we just listened to the demos in the studio, and if I liked what Pete was doing on bass, I'd do something similar. If I didn't, I'd completely change it around. You know, most of the time I changed it around completely. But the only way you could really sort of distinguish what we all actually did at the sessions would be to listen to the demos and then the actual songs, and you know, to see how different they are. As far as content is concerned, I think the album that I've been happiest with has been in Who's Next. But as far as the sound's concerned, I think the one I always continually listen to is Live at Leeds. That was about the easiest one we ever did. I was relieved at the quality of Live at Leeds because we decided that we were going to record two shows, which were, you know, sort of one day at Leeds, and I can't remember where the other one was, but it was about 100 miles away from Leeds. And we didn't have much choice because the other concert that we did, the bass didn't get recorded. So we were just stuck with Leeds. Yeah. And the only trouble we had with it was one of the brakes in Magic Bus was, it just completely fell apart. So Pete just cut a couple of feet out of the tape and turned it over. So we got a little backwards bit to bring us into the sort of chorus at the end. I just think I spent too much time in the studio. You know, I'm in this business for live shows. I mean, that's why I wanted to become a musician, you know, to play on stage to live audiences. And being stuck in a studio with no audience, you know, I don't play as well in the studio. I get bored when I'm not playing bass. So producing other bands is really sort of Yawnsville. You know, I find myself trying not to go to sleep or wanting to rush out and grab the bass player's bass away from him and start playing, you know, really sort of. It's the sort of thing I'd like to do if I lost a hand or in, say, 10 years' time, if I ever felt that I didn't want to play anymore. When I left school, I had a choice of either sort of going to the Royal Academy of Music and studying French horn, or going to art school or becoming a commercial artist. But none of those sort of earned any money, and I wanted to go out to work to earn money, so I went into the Internal Revenue, which is the Inland Revenue in England, and spent 3 years sort of rotting away in an office. You know. I was playing like sort of six nights a week in the evenings with The Who, so pretty soon I started earning more with the band than I was in the Inland Revenue, so I figured, well, it's, you know, we'd just given a record contract as the high numbers, and it was about time to get out of the job. You know. So I gave up my day job. While I was still at school, I intended to go into music full time. You know, that's what I wanted to be, a rock and roll musician. But you know, you've got parents that don't want you to do that sort of thing. You know, they don't want you to sort of go into music because it's too risky a business. They want you to get a nice solid job or study to be a doctor or something. You know, my son, the doctor, they're very sort of protective. They read all the interviews that I do. They sort of cut them out of the papers and everything. But When I turned professional, they were very worried. You know. I had to bring back a contract from their manager saying that I was going to actually be given £20 a week for a certain amount of years before they, you know. We usually work out the stage list, you know, what we're going to play at rehearsals. We more or less run through everything we know at rehearsals, and then try and work out a good sort of order for the stage act. Roger usually decides what goes where. He compiles the list so that if the show doesn't work for any reason, we can blame him. Because if we made up the list, he'd blame us. A lot of the Quadrophenia stuff was very complicated. We tried using tapes on stage, and we found it too restricting. And the main problem with Quadrophenia was that by the time we came out here on tour, we did a like 4 week tour, and the album had only been out a week, so people really hadn't got into the material, and it was about 2/3 of the stage act at that time. You know, we played it more or less in its entirety, just missing out a couple of songs, and it just didn't work for us. So we didn't have time halfway through a tour to start rehearsing another stage act, so we dropped out most of Quadrophenia and brought in songs that we hadn't played for quite a time but could still remember, you know, stuff like Substitute and Tattoo and stuff like that. We usually tour with one band in particular that we, you know, sort of decide on before we start touring. We usually tour England first, so whatever, if we tour with a band that we really like, say like last time it was Steve Gibbons, you know, we'll try and take them to the States with us. Usually we pick someone that's completely different from us. I mean, the only mistake we ever made was, as far as support bands were concerned, was when we toured with the Golden Earrings, which were so similar to us that by the time we got on stage, the audience had been deafened and completely drained, you know, and we were playing to a really limp audience. So we decided never to do that again. We usually pick someone that's completely different, you know, another sort of type of music than us. We're planning to do a concert to coincide with the Cannes Film Festival. We're showing Quadrophenia there, and we figure the best way to attract attention to the film is to have us there actually sort of playing at the same time. I should imagine that will be the first gig that we do during this year, but then we're planning to do some English concerts, and we're trying to get over to do an East Coast tour around about August. I've got a stand-up bass, but I don't know, I'd play it a lot better when I sort of stick it on my knee sideways, you know. Bill Wyman seems to be the only person that could adapt to that, but then his bass would have to be 2 foot high because he's got such small hands, you know. I like the sound of a stand-up bass, but I don't think I could use it in our music. You know, it just wouldn't work in our sound on stage. It'd be very hard to amplify for a start at the volume we use. I've got a fretless bass that I use quite a bit. It's made by an English company called Wall, and it's actually got white fret marks on it, you know, which shows you where you're going. And if I stood up on stage with a straight sort of plank neck, I just wouldn't know where I was going at all. As far as bass players go, I suppose my favourite bass players are... I listen to Stanley Clarke and Jaco Pastorius, but it's not really my sort of kind of bass playing, yeah. I admire their technical ability, but... McCartney's a pretty good bass player, sort of very inventive. You know, what he actually plays is very simple, but I like what he does. And as far as funky bass players are concerned, I think Larry Graham's pretty good. I think my influences musically were more along the lines of sort of Duane Eddy, you know, sort of instrumental bands like that. My playing style on bass, because of the sort of twangy sound I use, is more sort of country and western rather than funky. Although I've got into the sort of funky way of sort of playing just lately, because of the type of basses I've been using. You know, I've been very, you know, suitable for that sound, but I think mainly sort of country and western. I really enjoy going out on the road on my own. There are a few sort of setbacks, like the you know, I really didn't get on with the guitarist, and I couldn't really get on with the way he played on stage. But I don't think I'd actually form a band like that again. Most of the sort of weight of the group was put on me, although I think I managed to handle it pretty well. It was pretty strenuous, you know. That's when I first got the cycling flask on the mic stand, because I couldn't go back to my amplifier anymore to get my drink. So it had to be on the mic stand so I could make an announcement, take a swig out of the bottle with a straw, and then do all the singing and playing as well. You know. I started getting bored with the guitar solos part of the way through, so I just turned up and played all the guitar solos on bass instead. A lot of people actually realised what I actually contributed to The Who on stage. Once they heard me without The Who, they realised that it was very confusing, you know, playing with Pete, because we use a very similar sound. You know, the bass sounds like a guitar and the guitar sounds like a bass, so people confuse exactly what we're doing. Yeah, I think we opened up a whole new style of rock and roll. We were the first band to use really sort of heavy amplifiers, you know, a lot of amplifiers. When we first started, everybody had tiny little Fender amps or Vox amps, you know, all lined up together on stage, and everybody played pretty quietly. And we bullied Marshall into making 100-watt amps, We'd be going out with like 16, 12-inch speakers each and sort of blasting the audience. And it just opened up a whole new style of rock and roll. I mean, it was really sort of heavy rock. And then Hendrix came along and bought a duplicate set of our equipment. And Cream came along after that and used the same equipment. But I mean, we actually sort of designed those Marshall amps. You know, we told them what they should be and what they should do and how powerful they should be. And I think I contributed a whole lot to sort of bass playing. I actually started the lead bass sort of style of playing. When I first started, bass guitar was sort of bass guitar. It was just either a clack or a thump in the background. And I learned to play bass on Duane Eddy records. You know, I played the lead line on bass. So if anybody has influenced me, I think it's probably Duane Eddy. I mean, I learned to play with his style, and that's how I got the whole twangy sound, you know, that I use on stage. Only I play an octave lower than he did. I think there's a whole new audience that like to dance to music. I mean, dancing to music hasn't been that popular until the last few years. I mean, when everybody stopped jiving. There wasn't that much dancing to do to music. You know, people just sat down and listened to it. I mean, you can't dance to Led Zeppelin, and you can't really dance to our music. So we figured we'd try and appeal to a different audience. Yeah, I don't think music has actually gone anywhere in the 70s. You know, it's I mean, music's gone through sort of like flower power, and then it went through glitter. Punk, you know, the sort of music didn't really change that much, particularly. I think the punk thing was, in a lot of ways, a step backwards, but it also gave a lot of new bands a sort of opportunity to make records, you know, and some of them are really, really good. But a lot of the bands just won't last. I don't think they'll last through the 80s. I met the Jam down the speakeasy one night, and we sat at the table, and they were griping about, you know, they didn't like any Who material after Tommy, you know, or from Tommy onwards. And they said we'd lost contact with the kids on the street. I tried to explain to them that directly you become a professional musician, you have to leave the streets. I mean, the kids force you to separate. And the bigger you get, the further you get away from the kids. And they just couldn't understand it. You know, they figured that we'd made a mistake somewhere. But I mean, you can't play to 25,000 people and then walk out into the audience and shake hands with them. You know. And you can't, you find it very hard to identify with the way the kids feel, unless you spend a lot of time talking to them. The kids don't want you to go down to their level, yeah. Really. I mean, a lot of the fans I've met, you know, quite a few times, are upset if I spend too much time talking to them. Yeah. I don't know, they seem to, if they actually get in contact with the people that they admire, some of the tinsel wears off. Yeah. We don't really know how Keith's death is going to affect us until really we start rehearsals. You know, as far as our sound's concerned, it's going to completely sort of transform it. You know, I mean, it's going to transform the way I play bass. You know, I built my bass playing up around his style of drumming for so many years. I really don't know how things are going to turn out. We haven't really made a decision about any extra members of the band yet. I mean, Kenny Jones is the drummer, but we're not sure whether we're going to get an extra lead guitarist in or extra keyboard player. I think we're going to try rehearsing just the four of us, and then see what happens, see if we need anybody else. I feel a bit selfish about it in a way. I don't really want any extra members in the band because it's not going to leave enough holes for me to fill up as a bass player. I like playing lead bass. And if you've got a keyboard player playing melodic lines, then it's going to cut down my melodic lines. We always, when we're in the studio and on stage, we always talk about holes. The first one to invent like a melodic phrase to fill a hole up is the one who gets that hole, right? And the more instruments, the less holes for everybody. And I'm very selfish about it. I don't really want it to change that much because I'm used to playing bass how I do. I think because we've always been proud that we're an English band in America, an English band playing to our English audiences. And to make it a sort of an international band would probably change the image a little bit too much. I think the main difference between English and American bands is that the American ones are a lot more laid back. They seem to be sort of, on average, a lot more laid back. They place a lot more value on vocal harmony and stuff like that. I don't know, I can't really explain it. English musicians have got a different way of playing. We just use sort of different chords, different chord progressions. A lot harder, in a way.